Well, friends, would you turn in the scriptures to Nehemiah again and to chapter 6, Nehemiah chapter 6. Nehemiah chapter 6. I want to read this chapter to you and then we'll look at the whole chapter again tonight, as this is one of the historical passages of God's word. Let's hear the word of the Lord again. The readings we've already had, I hope, will have set the scene for some of the things we're going to be thinking of this evening. Nehemiah 6. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies heard that I had rebuilt the wall and that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors or the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, saying, "Come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono." But they thought to do me harm. But I sent messengers to them, saying, "I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you?" But they sent me this message four times, and I answered them in the same manner. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me as before, the fifth time, with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says, that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to the rumors, you are rebuilding the wall, that you may be their king. And you have also appointed prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, saying, 'There is a king in Judah.' Now these matters will be reported to the king. So come, therefore, and let us consult together." Then I sent to him, saying, "No such things as you say are being done, but you invent them in your own heart. For they were all trying to make us afraid, saying, 'Their hands will be weakened in the work, and it will not be done.' Now, therefore, O God, strengthen my hands." Afterward, I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was a secret informer, and he said, "Let us meet together in the house of God within the temple, and let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you." And I said, "Should such a man as I flee? And who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in." Then I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he had pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act that way and sin, so that they might have cause for an evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these their works, and the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid." So the wall was finished on the 25th day of Elul, in 52 days. And it happened when all our enemies heard of it, and all the nations around saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was done by our God. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah sent many letters to Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came to them, for many in Judah were pledged to him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Arah, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshullam, the son of Berechiah. Also they reported his good deeds before me, and reported my words to him. Tobiah sent letters to frighten me." Well, here we have this amazing account of these last events when finally the wall was completed. Nehemiah's faithful workers had worked hard and long, and although they'd had some difficulties in chapter 4 and in chapter 5, yet those who were with Nehemiah were very positive and supportive of him. But his enemies took this incredible opportunity to attack him in a number of different ways in this chapter, and to try to at least defeat the work at the last. Here we begin the chapter with the wall rebuilt, amazingly, in such a short time. But the gates had not been set up, so this was in a sense the last attempt to try to defeat this work for a great onslaught from their enemies. Because if they could do this before the gates went up, then they had succeeded. But if the gates went up, then they knew that they were defeated. But they come now, and they are very subtle in their attacks. Satan never gives up. He is out to destroy us if he can. And he will do every conceivable thing to try to destroy us. My friends, we need to stand. We need to know. We need to be ready for his attacks. We never know quite where he's coming from. Sometimes I know pastors have spoken to me and they've said, what do you do when there's trouble in the church? How do you prepare for it? My standard answer, and I think it's the right answer, is to say you cannot, because you never know from where it is going to come. The devil never tells you beforehand what he's going to do, or how he's going to cause trouble, or what he's going to do to upset people. And I've known that in many, many experiences over my life and ministry. The devil never gives up. He knows our weak points. And he knows how to attack the key man. And if he can disable Nehemiah, then the work will cease. And that's why we need to pray for those who are in the ministry, particularly. This is not special pleading on my part. This is just a fact, the facts of life. To pray for people who are exposed in that sense, who are particularly under the attack of the evil one. And he has no sympathy, Satan. He has no kindly feelings towards any. He is full of malice and vindictive hatred. And he doesn't care who he tramples on or what he does or what evil he promotes. He's got nothing to lose. His doom is sealed anyway. He will attempt to wreak as much havoc as he can before the end of time. And so we need to do all we can to shun him and oppose him and stand against him. Now, what has happened here is that the enemy has tried all kinds of direct attacks. But now that the attacks are much more subtle and much more crafty, and in many ways, they're an insight into some of the ways in which the devil can attack us today. So I hope, although in many ways some of these things are quite sad and quite difficult, I hope we'll be encouraged to learn how to stand against the devil's attacks. Because this chapter is actually a chapter of triumph, because the work was completed and the gates were hung, and there is great blessing, as we shall see in a moment or two. So now they have seen that with Nehemiah, outward scorn and ridicule doesn't work. Now they are much more subtle. And there are a number of forms of the attack of the evil ones. Firstly, notice what I'm going to call carnal compromise. Carnal compromise, verses 1 to 4. They come and they try to make him compromise. Satan delights to show the people of God as narrow, as bigoted, as unfriendly, as self-righteous. Now, of course, that's not true, but that's what the devil delights to make people think. It was very interesting that Spurgeon was frequently called by his enemies a bigot. And he said on one occasion, and you can read it in one of his sermons, he said, "I am repeatedly called a bigot," he said. "Do you know what the word bigot means? It means, the first bit, B-I, is actually by, and got is a bad way of referring to God." He says, "A bigot is a man who stands by God." He said, "Well, if that's the case," he said, "I'm a bigot and I'm happy to be called it." You understand what he was saying. Now you understand, I'm sure he wasn't happy, but you understand what he's saying. If you're going to call me a bigot, yes, if you're going to say that because I stand by God and because I preach God's truth, that's fine. I'm quite happy to be called it in that sense. If you're just using it to slander me, well, then I will stand against that, because that is not fair and that is not kind. But I am a man who's going to stand by God. But that's what the devil does, doesn't he? He wants to make out that we are narrow, that we are bigoted, that we're miserable, that we are, you know, how many times people have said, they talk about Christians being hypocrites or being miserable. Sometimes when they say that to me, I say, well, yes, we are hypocrites in one sense, because we cannot do what we claim to do by ourselves. But what we do is by the grace of God. And we're not claiming ourselves to be good, and we're not claiming to be right. And sometimes when people say to me, only good people go to heaven, I say, well, actually, no, it's sinners who go to heaven, sinners saved by the grace of God. None of us are good in that sense, you understand. Now, in any other situation, in any secular situation, any worldly situation, and certainly in the days of Nehemiah, if Nehemiah had done what he had done, in any other situation, he would have been applauded for his courage, for his conviction, for his stickability, for his resolute determination to get on with the work and do it to a good standard. But because he was the servant of God, the devil wanted to make out that he was narrow and self-righteous. And so this is very subtle. Sanballat and Geshem come to Nehemiah in verse 2. Come, let us meet together among the villages in the plain of Ono. Come on, Nehemiah, let's talk together. Let's be friends together. Now we know that there is a sense in which the best thing to do is to talk. It's far better to talk than to war. Wasn't it Churchill who said, jaw, jaw, jaw is better than war, war, war? Well, that's true. Sometimes it's good to talk. Don't be narrow, don't be fanatical. But here, what they were wanting to do was by subtle innuendo to lead Nehemiah astray and to bring him down to their level. Now, they did this, as I say, because the walls were built, but the gates were not yet hung. They knew that if the gates were put up, they would lose their chance. If they don't trap Nehemiah now, if they don't deceive him now, if they don't sidetrack him now, if they don't tempt him to compromise now, the opportunity will be gone. And it is so easy, isn't it, to be swayed by the charge, perhaps, that we are narrow-minded, or to compromise on Christian standards. The devil is so subtle. And yet Nehemiah's answer is a wonderful answer in verse 3. He sent messengers to them. He didn't go and talk to them. He sent messengers. That's sometimes a wise thing to do. Often the best way of defusing situations is to see people face to face. But sometimes when it's an onslaught like this, he sends messengers. I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and go down to you? Now they continued to try to get him to do this. They tried to wear him down with their repeated requests. Verse 4, they sent this message 4 times, but I answered them the same manner. I am doing a great work. My friends, that is a wonderfully comforting thing to say, isn't it? To know that we are doing a great work for God. And that whatever the devil may do, and whatever the world may throw at us, we will not compromise, we will not stop. Your work is a great work for God. Now in those days, particularly in that area at the time, what was Jerusalem? Well, it was only a little city, it was only a small city. We'll have something more to say about it when we come to chapter 7, something glorious to say when we come to chapter 7. Not that I'm going to say anything negative now, but compared with Babylon, it was nothing. You remember when Jonah went to Nineveh to preach. It was a 3-day journey before he got from the outside into the center of the city. Now Babylon was a great city like that as well. Babylon and Nineveh, they were mighty cities and great places. Jerusalem was just a little, small, insignificant city. It was nothing compared with Babylon, nothing compared with the palace at Shushan, but it was God's city, and God was at work. My friends, if we're working for God, we're doing a great work. What work do you do? Well, you may be doing ordinary work, you may be doing secular work, but if you're a Christian, you're doing God's work. You understand? You are God's man, God's woman, God's person, serving him and working for him. And however unfulfilling and how troublesome and however wearying and however unsatisfying or however satisfying the work is, it is the work that God has given you to do, and you do it to the glory of his name. What a wonderful thing it is to know that. But then there's another aspect to this here, because here are the walls being completed. And the Bible often talks about walls, doesn't it? And it talks about the walls of salvation. Isaiah has a lot to say about that, and other prophets. And as God's walls of salvation are going up, so the devil realizes that his time is short. And so he is seeking his final major victories before his end and doom is sealed. And he gets more furious and more angry and more antagonistic and more hatred against the people of God. And if you're a Christian, Satan hates you with all his malice and spite to try to trip you up and to defeat you and to spoil you and to mar your witness. How wonderful to know that our God is the great God who can keep us. And round us he builds the walls of salvation and he keeps us safe. Whenever we sin, the devil rubs his hands with glee. And whenever we fail the Lord, the devil gloats. And whenever our faith grows cold, Satan rejoices. And whenever there's dissension in the church, the devil rejoices. We are doing a great work. Don't let the devil get in. Don't let the devil spoil our witness and our testimony. Nehemiah refused to be sidetracked. He refused to compromise. He refused to come down. He stood firm, even though they tried to wear him down. Carnal compromise. The second thing is what I've called subtle slander in verses 5 to 9. Now, as I was reading that a moment or two ago, I was just thinking about, you know, we have this, we often talk, don't we, today about fake news. How do we know whether news is true or not? How much fake news there is about, and things that are said by one, and then somebody says something else, and sometimes you don't know what to believe. Well, this was fake news. Here's fake news in the Old Testament. Here are these people who are sending these slanderous letters out about Nehemiah. And it was a pack of lies from beginning to end. And what they were doing was, if you'll pardon the expression, they were trying to put the frighteners on him. Here is an open letter. Here is a public letter for all to see. I can't remember who it was, but one of the men who've been dictators in their lives, was it Stalin or it might have been Hitler, I can't remember. If you're going to tell a lie, tell a big one, because it'll stick. If you're going to tell a lie, tell a big one. And everyone eventually will believe you. And isn't that what happens sometimes? Here is a public letter, and it's very difficult to live down untrue slander. Don't bear false witness, false testimony against our neighbor. The devil is the slanderer. One of the meanings of the word devil is slanderer. To slander someone is to do the devil's work for him. Now, friends, I'm not saying that you would do that. Bless you. I'm not accusing. But you see what they're doing here. They're trying to slander him. They're trying to spread this false new word. Idle, ignorant words, rumors going around, but there's no truth in them. They were saying that Nehemiah was setting himself up as king in Jerusalem. Now Nehemiah verse 8 emphatically denies this false rumor. It was an ugly lie. And Satan's whole attempt, we're told in verse 9, they were trying to make us afraid, saying their hands will be weakened in the work and it will not be done. And everything they were doing was to try to get Nehemiah to give up. Now, my friends, we need to take notice of that, don't we? Because the devil will do his utmost to stop us doing what is right and proper. He will do his utmost to stop us reading the Bible and praying daily, regularly. And it's so easy to give in to the devil's temptation. And he can sometimes come with such spiritual sounding words. We'll come to that in a minute or two. Sometimes we may feel that we don't feel like praying, or we feel so unworthy. And the devil will whisper in our ears and say, "You are so unworthy and you're so sinful. How dare you come to God?" And the devil, he's being very subtle, but he's trying to stop us from doing the one thing which will help us, which is to keep on coming to the Lord and trusting him. Nehemiah's prayer is a profound prayer here, isn't it? Verse to the end of verse 9, "Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands." You see, if we are praying people, Satan treats us with contempt. He doesn't like us. He thinks we're fools. He despises our praying. He loathes us, and he will do everything to weaken us and make us afraid. Do you know that, my friend? I'm sure some of you do, bless you. I certainly do. I certainly know sometimes how, when I come to pray, how difficult it seems to be. And the old devil is doing his utmost to discourage us and drag us down. And as we shall see, even after the wall was finished, The enemy was still trying to frighten Nehemiah. Verse 19, we'll come to that in a moment or two. Subtle slander, carnal compromise, subtle slander. Thirdly, religious scandal, verses 10 to 14. This is a very, very tricky case now. What does Nehemiah do? What do Nehemiah's enemies do? What they do is they hire false prophets who masquerade as true prophets to try to seduce him into the temple under a concern for his safety. Now, what they're saying here, and you need to understand it, this is not just, shall we go to the temple? No, this is actually to go into the inner part of the temple, which only the priests were allowed to enter. And they were saying, look, you need to be careful because there are people who are after your life. This is a prophecy to keep you safe. God has told us this in order to keep you safe. They're coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they will come to kill you. Verse 10. Now that's enough to frighten anybody, isn't it? If you heard that somebody was coming to kill you, I think you'd be frightened. This last time when I was in the Philippines, one of our students was preaching on the Thursday night on the Thursday night at the drop-in center. Now, the drop-in center is where people off the streets who live on the streets, very rough and ready people who have no homes, they sleep on the streets. They're very rough and ready, and there's all kinds of things that go on, and in the providence of God, one or two have been converted. But one of our men was preaching. One of the students at the college was preaching one night. And at the end of the meeting, he was actually threatened by somebody with a knife. Now, my friends, I don't know what you would do if you're threatened with a knife. We hear a lot about knifings and people being knifed and killed in this country today, don't we? And people who are stabbed. But it's not very nice to be presented with a knife. And I think it was an 8-inch knife, some 6 or 8-inch knife. It wasn't a small thing. It wasn't a pen knife. It wasn't just an ordinary. It was a blade. And I don't know about you, but I think I'd be pretty scared if I suddenly found I was facing a man who was so incensed with my preaching that he was going to stab me. Now, I'm not quite sure how it was resolved, but clearly the man didn't kill him. But he said, I've been threatened. He came to me and he said, Pastor Ian, he said, I've been threatened. He said, what can I do? And I said, well, you better talk to some of the Filipinos because they know, talk to the Filipino pastors, talk to them. They know better than I, but I'll certainly pray with you and talk to you. And so I talked to him, and the man, he was shaking like a leaf, and I can well understand that. What do you do when somebody threatens you? Well, here is this man, Nehemiah, and he said, they're coming by night tonight, they're going to kill you. That's a pretty serious threat, isn't it? What can we do to keep safe? Well, you come into the temple and we'll lock the doors and you'll be safe. But Nehemiah knew that as a man who was not a priest, he had no right to be in that part of the temple. And so he turns to them and he says, verse 11, and should such a man as I flee? And who is there such as I who would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. And it was then he perceived, verse 12, that God had not sent him, but that he had pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. But he didn't know that when he first heard it. But he was a man who knew God, and he was prepared to trust God. Not to take risks, unnecessary risks, but to trust God in a desperate situation. Now, this was very dangerous because it came under the guise of prophetic advice. But the reason was to make him afraid, verse 13. But again, Nehemiah comes to God. Verse 14, my God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to these works, these their works, and the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who would have made me afraid. They ganged up, they got all the prophets to preach against him. Religious scandal. Fourthly, what do we find? Well, we find dedicated success. Verses 15 to 16. So the wall was finished. In spite of these three attempts already, the wall is finished. It is finished. in the 25th day of Elul, in 52 days. My friends, I know that Jerusalem was relatively small compared with Babylon and with Nineveh. But that was still a mighty fast job to rebuild the walls in that time. Amazing. This was God's work. This was God's work. The devil is defeated. The devil is dismayed. The enemies are thrown into confusion and disheartened. Verse 16, when all our enemies heard of it and all the nations around us saw these things, that they were very disheartened in their own eyes. They saw these things. They were disheartened, for they perceived, they understood that this work was done by our God. This was God's work, and the devil was defeated and dismayed. And they had to acknowledge that God was at work. God has brought victory to his people. Satan will never have the last word. God's hand was upon Nehemiah. Thank God. In spite of great opposition and many obstacles, the work was completed. We'll say more about that when we come to chapter 7. Wonderful things we have to say about that. Well, I won't preempt that now. But they had to acknowledge that this was God's work. God's favor was upon his servant. The pulpit commentary makes this comment: neither open threats nor secret plots weakened the strength or lessened the labor of the busy workmen, and the good work was accomplished, and all glory was given to God. The enemy was humiliated and defeated. Seek the Lord, that he will vindicate his truth among us in these days, that the world may be much cast down in their own eyes. Men are too full of their own self-importance. They need to be cast down before the mighty works of God. Thank God that this work had been completed, and they had to acknowledge that God was with them. However, that wasn't the end of the attacks and the opposition, because fifthly, we see here devious opponents, verses 17 to 19. Now the tactics change. Also in those days, the very phrase says that not only immediately, but ongoing, there was ongoing opposition, ongoing difficulty. These were now much more devious and underhand. Who are these? Now, these are not only Sanballat and Tobiah, we find out that they're involved, but now here are the nobles. You remember the nobles who've been so unsupportive in the building work. The nobles who had thought to bring to defeat Nehemiah, and they'd tried to oppose him. Well, first they hadn't got involved in the building, but then they were behind some of the opposition that we read about in chapters 4 and 5. But this was scurrilous and wicked, because they get Tobiah. Send letter to Tobiah, and they try to undermine Nehemiah's authority. It was a dangerous alliance between the nobles and the enemy as they tried to scheme and plan to defeat Nehemiah, even after the success of the wall building. My friends, when wicked people cannot get their own way, they will attack even the work of God. The rage of the ungodly knows no bounds. And they pledge themselves to Tobiah because of intermarriage, we find. Now, sometimes it's family connections that cause the greatest of problems, isn't it? People are more afraid of their family sometimes than they are of the things of God. The fear of offending ungodly family members or challenging ungodly actions sometimes can cripple a person's witness and testimony. I've known that sadly in some cases. The fear of man brings a snare, says the Bible. And don't we see it? Don't we see it in our own land and nation? People who want to get their own way, and they're not going to stop at anything until they get their own way. Never mind who they trample on or what they do or what they say or how they react. But my friends, we're reminded also that God is sovereign in all these great situations. And in Ray Brown's lovely little commentary on Nehemiah on the Bible Speaks Today series, he reminds us that there are two lessons that we learn from this chapter. One about the enemy and one about the Lord. And I want to close by just giving you these and just saying a few things about this. Firstly, the first lesson we learn is the enemy's subtlety. How subtle the devil is when he attacks us. How subtle he is in his temptations. And the temptations for God's servants today are just as powerful as those that Nehemiah faced in this chapter. Temptation to materialism, things. We spoke a little bit about that in reference this morning. Things, people after things, money, possessions. The temptation to this material world, which is but for a vapor and vanishes away. The temptations to secularism, to ignore God, to forget about God, to get on with this world, that temptation is still a very real temptation. The lust for money, the greedy nobles here, those who refuse to obey God's law about marriage, well, here they were, they intermarried with the enemy. The lust for power as they try to destroy Nehemiah. These are all evidences of the devil's wicked work. He's still at the same game. He's still out to try to destroy the people of God with the same kind of temptations today. The subtlety of the enemy. That's one thing that we need to learn. Please God, we will learn it. But the second thing is that the Lord is always sufficient. The Lord is always sufficient. And Nehemiah stands in this chapter as a testimony to the purity of a godly character in the face of incredible pressure to compromise and to give in. Now, I don't know about you, but we face, don't we, all kinds of pressures and stresses in this life. Some of us, you know, some people, when they're under stress, what do? They go to the doctor because they want to get rid of the stress. Now, if it gets too extreme, of course, they need to do that and need to sort it. Please, I'm not saying that we shouldn't seek to do. But life has its stresses. Life without stress is as dangerous as life with too much stress, if you understand what I'm trying to say. Life is full of trials, but James tells us he gives us more grace. He gives us more grace. And one of the reasons we read those words from 2 John this evening is because John knew the case of those who oppose the work of God and the difficulties of those. Many deceivers have gone out into the world who do not confess Jesus Christ. This is a deceiver and an antichrist. Look to yourselves that we don't lose the things that we worked for. And he's out to protect the believers. He's spoken of the wonderful way in which he rejoices because they're walking in the truth, and he wants them to go on walking in the truth. Why? Because the Lord is always sufficient. The Lord is always the one who encourages us. We are abiding in the doctrine of Christ. We have both the Father and the Son, John tells us. What an amazing thing that is. I rejoiced greatly that I have found some of your children walking in the truth as we have received commandment from the Father. This is love, that we walk according to his commandments. That's the wonder of it, because God is always sufficient for us, for every need. As one of our hymns says, he gives more grace when the burdens grow greater. Thank God for that. Now, I know that's a hymn, but that's the principle that's being outlined here. And when the pressure is on, and when the stress levels are almost overpowering, remember, my friends, that the Lord our God is with us, and that his sufficiency will see us through. And Nehemiah stands here as a wonderful encouragement to us as we look at the way in which he was battered and bruised by all these different kinds of attack, full of frontal attacks, but then all these subtle attacks. And yet he remains standing true for God. Thank God for his testimony. And how did he do it? By continually committing himself into the hands of an all-gracious and all-loving God. So, my friends, let us resolve, by God's grace, to be the best for God, to live for him, to serve him, that the devil will be seen to be defeated as he was here, and that God will get all the glory as we seek to serve him and work for him and go forward for him in the blessings of his grace. Well, we're going to close this service by singing a hymn about the wonder of the grace of God and his glory as we consider these things. Number 58, glory be to God the Father, glory be to God the Son, glory be to God the Spirit, great Jehovah, three in one. This is our God, and he will get all glory to himself, and as his people, let us join in that glory and rejoice with him. Number 58.